The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Welcome, everyone. I'm going to start to sing Happy Birthday to You, Happy Birthday to You, Happy Birthday, dear Abraham Lincoln, Happy Birthday to You. Good afternoon, everyone. Father Tom Coy's here with you. Even though we don't get this day off, the President's Days are smooshed together. I can't help but dedicate a bit of my Winds of Change time with you to some of the salient points of this important figure in history and hope that it can shed light on the world we live in today. I see some very powerful parallels and gives me a chance to do a shameless plug for a book that I put together a while back, but I still think it's so pertinent for today. It's called the book. Some of you longtime listeners of The Winds of Change will know right away, right? The book title is The Ashes That Still Remain. The Ashes That Still Remain. You can get it on, I think you can get it on Amazon.com still. If not, you can certainly text me at unlikeothernations@gmail.com. unlikeothernations@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to put a copy in the mail for you. It's a book on what I call the conversion of Abraham Lincoln. That's a polite way to describe a guy who was trying to be a moderate in the worst way in order to get into office as moderate in relationship to the issue of slavery, though he couldn't hold that moderate position in the end. He certainly was anti-abortion in his heart. He tried to dance the political dance, especially as we see him rising to power so quickly, really. The debates he had with Senator Stephen Douglas were all about the issue of slavery, and it did help him get into the presidency, of course, but as soon as he was elected, the South couldn't handle that and broke out by attacking Fort Sumter. Okay, so that's a little bit of history there. But I want to share with you sort of the essence of my book here, and it gives me a chance. I'll go through some little quotes here and there, some tidbits, and connect it to today. I can't help but connect it to today. Why I wrote this book has been asked me many times, and I pretty much give the same answer, that discovering the difficulty with talking about the right to life issue today, you know, it is difficult to talk about it in a lot of ways. We try to, in polite company, avoid such ugly things, shall we say. And I thought maybe another way to approach, get people to really think about moral issues on a deeper level, is to revisit the great moral issue that doesn't divide us today, at being the issue of slavery. There's great unanimity. There's great togetherness in our opposition to slavery today.
Wow.
Indeed.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That's part of the brain wrinkling. But here's the kicker that pushed me to write the book. In a philosophical way, the ideas of the South won the American Civil War. The battle was won by Grant and the Northern armies, of course, and Abraham Lincoln did issue his Emancipation Proclamation, and slavery was outlawed, codified, all the rest in our laws. But there's something of a philosophical residue that is still with us today. And that's why I wrote this book about the ashes that still remain.
Oh, when will this mad whirlwind existence ever stop?
I think when the sun smashes into the earth or sometime like that, or however God's going to bring about the end of the world. I don't believe it's going to be global warming is going to do us in. Well, us humans are smart enough to figure out how to combat that issue. It doesn't worry me as much as the moral demise where we ourselves are capable of destroying ourselves because of a radical different understanding of
no!
right and wrong. Yeah, that's what some people might react to that position I just shared with you. Let me read a little bit from this book, The Ashes That Still Remain, since today is February 12th. But it's Abraham Lincoln is a wonderful president. No matter what day you're listening to this podcast or this radio show on, I say in my introduction, on the philosophical level, though the South lost the war on the battlefield, it is not difficult to conclude that it won the battle for the American mind. Philosophically speaking, it is Jefferson Davis, not Abraham Lincoln, who embodies our spirit as we cross into the 21st century. The willingness, even eagerness, to live with moral ambiguity and to covet peace at the expense of a truth about human nature and a truth about justice in treating human beings, to preserve entrenched institutions and the status quo, and to complacently accept what the previous generation has passed along as its legacy of a just society. These were the spoils of war left to us a century after Lee surrendered at Appomattox. See what I'm trying to tickle your fancy there. I'm trying to tickle your brain. Or wrinkle it, tickle or wrinkle, whichever way you want.
Wow. That's, just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, it's supposed to. I'm trying to wrinkle it because in order to really appreciate the what was going on, what almost destroyed our nation in the American Civil War, it's important to see this deep moral crisis that we had. And the minority, the abolitionist spirit really began as a minority. So it's hard not to agree, not to see that. Abraham Lincoln was against slavery, but he didn't want to abolish slavery at first. That was the whole idea of let's compromise or let's draw lines across the nation and. Some places will be allowed to have slavery. Other in the north of the lines, we won't have. Or and then there was that attempt, and then there was the other attempt at let one state enter the Union slave, and another open to slavery, and another enter the Union free. So it was a second form of a compromise. And then the third form of the compromise, which is really very popular today. It's a favorite strategy of anyone in a difficult moral position, is the third strategy of compromise would be called the let them decide. So the people on the federal, national level, in order to avoid great conflict, they would let the states decide. And so, but none of those three worked. None of those three kinds of compromises worked. And but the philosophical battle where you would you would try to use all those compromises with new and different moral issues really kind of won the day. And the spirit behind the Confederacy protecting its right to slavery is what is the same kind of spirit, same kind of philosophical positions that those who oppose right to life legislation or defending the unborn are using, and parallels are many. Let me go to another one here, where I put down a little bit more basically why I wrote this book. I've written this book because I love my country, and like so many of my countrymen, I seek a way to leave for the next generation an America that has moved one step further towards the realization of the noble ideals expressed by our forebears in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And my interest in the Civil War opened up for me an avenue by which we can rediscover the key virtues that were once our nation's saving grace. All Americans can rightly be proud of these virtues and should disdain the foul residue that is left wherever they are lacking. I wish to illustrate in these pages how the conversion and subsequent moral fortitude of one man was responsible for saving the United States of America and strengthening for all time her position as a beacon of justice among the nations of the earth. I hope to make clear the cowardice that underlies the so-called moderate position held by politicians today in regard to the abortion debate and the promise of history's favorable judgment upon those who have the courage to be today's radicals. Perhaps this reflection will rekindle some of the passion and fighting spirit that was part of the Lincoln legacy. Obviously, when you look at the statue of Abraham Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, or which is also in the back of the penny, right? Although you can't look very well.
Whoa.
It's hard to see it on the back of the penny.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
He's there, but it's hard to see. And we don't use pennies too much except to round out change, I guess you could do. But anyway, the spirit of the fighting spirit for a just cause obviously is what animated Abraham Lincoln. He began to see that evil as the evil of slavery as a just cause, and had to defend it because he saw that it was ripping apart the nation. And we can see today debates, especially over the right to life, is ripping us apart. However, there seems to be a greater intense anger, or there's a kind of a hatred in the voice of the defenders of the right to abortion that is getting more uglier and uglier, because I think they sense they're getting more of a minority there. There's the many who have opposed, maybe many in the past who were taking neutral positions are now willing to take a pro-life position, in great part thanks to President Trump, who is fortified or strengthened the right to life movement. And of course, as soon as I say that, I know I'm going to, I would hear and I can anticipate questions that such a pro-life position by President Trump is filled with hypocrisy, filled with insincerity. It's not really, if you look at his former life and his womanizing and perhaps even having participated in an abortion here or there. We don't know that. I'm not saying that I know that, but it's if it were to be discovered, it wouldn't surprise me because of the kind of playboy lifestyle that he led. But the guy has certainly changed his stripes, and it's a beautiful thing to see. A convert is so often delightful, you know. I really believe he is a convert, and I say that in the sense that I believe Abraham Lincoln was a convert. Abraham Lincoln, like I said, didn't want to make any legislation freeing the slaves. He just wanted first just to avoid the issue in order to save the Union. But he felt he got to the point where he couldn't save the Union without freeing the slaves. And I think our current president, President Trump, has come to a similar kind of awakening where he was seeing, no, part of my wayward past was this belief in the right to abortion to sort of save people from their bad decisions, and so trying to put in.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah. It's trying to put in more conservative justices will help bring about a greater respect, a better formation of conscience on the part of our nation so that we won't fall into such playboy-type lifestyle, shall we say, that hurt, they could say hurt him personally or hurt others, of course. Some will say that he wasn't hurt at all, but I think inside that's got to be part of what he was dealing with. Let me read another section here about the relationship between the Abraham Lincoln and his appreciation for the wrongness of slavery and the appointing of Supreme Court justices. Because this is a little interesting twist. You might know the two names Seward and Chase. It's Samuel Chase and Seward. I can't remember his first name. Seward was they were both in his cabinet, and Seward was the more moderate. He didn't really he wanted to stay neutral on the slavery issue. Samuel Chase, on the other hand, was a strong abolitionist. Couldn't see how our American spirit of independence and freedom could continue while there's this institution of slavery. And Abraham Lincoln was better personal friends with Seward than he was with Chase. Let me share this little paragraph. For all their personal difficulties, at the bottom, Chase and Lincoln were of one heart and one mind about the importance of justice for the health of the nation. After the death of Roger Taney in October 12th, 1864, Taney was the Catholic Supreme Court judge who voted for maintaining slavery in the their landmark decision there. And so Lincoln looked to Salmon Chase to replace Taney on the Supreme Court. So there, Lincoln was replacing a pro-slavery guy with an anti-slavery guy. Even though the president was better friends with Seward, he recognized the enduring value of the position held by Salmon Chase, the anti-slavery position. He also knew that after the war, the court would be facing cases probing the strength and extent of his Emancipation Proclamation. He needed someone with the unmovable conviction of this matter to finish the work that had begun with the Emancipation Proclamation. He showed his appreciation for Chase's moral courage by appointing him to the Supreme Court. Chase, the radical, received presidential recognition for this so-called progressive thinking. I say it's progressive because at that time it wasn't conservative. The conservative voice was the voice that said, leave slavery alone, don't outlaw it. So that's an interesting combo, isn't it? And we'll need... We can appreciate that which went on a long time ago and that with which we are facing today. I need to make a little comment about our present political situation. There's something missing in the campaigns today that I don't think you may have thought of, but it's hitting me, and I got to share it with you. I'll come right back after this little break. I'm Father Tom Coys. You're listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Koska is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
The Winds of Change.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, by our highly educated and dedicated teachers, your gifted child will be at a higher and deeper level of thinking and conceptual understanding, so they will have a full comprehension of what they're learning in any subject. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced level placement opportunities, as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent, learn, lead, love. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's 1 block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Coys here on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. I've been sharing some thoughts on Abraham Lincoln since today, when I'm recording this, is his birthday. And I consider ignorance of Abraham Lincoln is ignorance of what the United States of America is. The essence, if you don't really see the deep issues of the American Civil War and the place of some of the great people involved in that drama, then you're missing the essence of this country that we live in so far, and there are wrinkles. There's echoes. There's ashes that still remain. That's the title of the book I wrote on this topic. that we need to appreciate. And the form of the ashes that remain is the political desire to be ambiguous on the definition of the human person, that we strive to, we're fearful for taking a stand and saying that the unborn is a person, so therefore it should be protected by the law like all other persons. So that issue obviously looms loud in our present political milieu. If you remember, if you're a faithful listener to The Winds of Change, I've played a few times that montage of complaints and sorrow on the night or the day after President Trump was elected back in 2016. And the lament and the cries and the sorrow had nothing to do with Russian collusion, had nothing to do with delaying holding aid to the Ukraine over his head. Nobody back in November of 2016 had any idea about those things, but they all were worried that the right to abortion would be undermined. That was the common thread that was spun through all the tears and whining of those who worried about him. And even though other politicians have been pro-life, this one seemed more dangerous. And I think Trump seemed more dangerous because deep down, I think they kind of knew he was a convert. He was going to attack harder because he's fighting in some ways to purge himself, to redeem himself. I can't help but think that he endures so much the negativity that he's getting, endured the impeachment thing. Part of him probably just enjoys the fight, right? And kind of enjoys a victory. And if you like the glow of victory, then you got to enjoy the battle of conflict. So that might be part of it. But of course, I think another subtle part of it is when you're fighting for something that you may have changed your mind on quite radically, and I think it's obvious that he has. He's enduring some of that negativity as kind of penance. He's sort of offering up this. He's enduring it because he knows he's sort of, like I say, purifying himself, as somebody who goes through a conversion. Sometimes we want a little pain, we want a little suffering because it helps us in our penitential spirit, as it were. So, but one thing, I got to point this out, something that's missing, and I don't think it's going to reappear the way it has, but for the past, I'm going to say 20, 30 years of my life and being a amateur political sideshow watcher, say that three times, in every campaign, there is a loud cry by many who aren't really on one side or the other. Many times middle of the roaders, they complain that the political ads are all negative, right? It's a way of saying I don't like either candidate. You know, a lot of people take that position. You know, they're all crooks, or I don't like any of them, and so we say something like, well, both sides are so negative. Both sides are dirty, and that's a common complaint of political ads. We all heard it over and over again. But let's see. I think I have a clip here. If I can do this, this was a commentary on the campaigns last time around, when something like
98-99% of the ads airing now are negative. There's a few Spanish language positive ads that are on the air now. Other than that, everything, absolutely everything that's on the air is negative.
That may change because, unlike the president, who is a known commodity, Romney will have to introduce himself to the general electorate. And experts believe he will have to roll out some positive message at some point.
Yeah, you remember things like that, of course. You couldn't listen to commentary on the campaigns without hearing that refrain. They're going negative. And a politician would say, I'm not going negative. I'm going to stay positive because the charge of being negative is so easily exposed, as it were. And notice that the commentary, I think that was from a CBS news show, and they put the pressure on Romney to go positive, though they didn't put the pressure on Obama to go positive. The reason I'm bringing that up now is that when you listen to the Democratic candidates that are going through all these primaries, we just had one in New Hampshire, where Bernie Sanders came out in first place. All of them, though, are united in completely basing their campaign on who can get rid of Trump, and that, my friends, is the height of negative campaigning. You see what I'm saying? It's not even pretending to be negative about a policy or two. They're not naming any policies. They're just saying that I have the best possibility of getting rid of the president. And if that's not negative campaigning, I don't know what is. I'd rather them be negative about this policy or that policy. So do you see what I'm saying? See what I'm saying? There's that's missing this time around. And
wow.
It's important for us. Yeah, hear it?
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is brain ringing. But you have to keep your brain working here for this, because we need to know, let's take a lesson from the absence of the criticism that there's negative campaigning going on. And the lesson that we need to take away from this is that when someone just complains about negativity without specificity, negativity without specificity, that the commentators that would say that all the campaigns are just negative, they sit, or they, that comes out of a moral neutrality, a fear of taking positions on moral issues, and therefore, but when you are attacking something that you really see as evil or wrong, attacking something you don't like isn't categorized as negative. It's positive. See what I'm saying? So the news commentators that would be pro Bernie Sanders or pro Elizabeth Warren, and Buttigieg, all these, the whole gamut, they don't want to comment on their campaigning strategy by saying it's negative, because in their mind they don't see it as negative, they see it as positive. Obviously, put simply, attacking an evil is a positive. Okay, so I don't think the president is evil. And so attacking him is not a positive in my book, but those who do see him as an evil are not going to accuse those who are attacking him as negative campaigning. It's an insight into the relativity of positive and negative. Positivity and negativity. We most of us like to consider ourselves optimists, and we don't like pessimists. But as G.K. Chesterton says, to always be optimistic and never be pessimistic is like giving someone directions to London and always telling them to take right turns and never telling them to take a left turn. His point is that if you're going to be objective about it, sometimes you're going to have to turn right and sometimes you're going to have to turn left to get to your destination. And so the terms left and right, go left or go right, or be positive and be negative, are completely dependent on your goal or what you're trying to achieve. Are you following me? Hope so. Anyways, let me end this meditation on Abraham Lincoln and subsequent parallel to our president today with one of my favorite stories that I didn't include in my book, which I got to share with you, my listeners, came in my research about our little parish where I am in the southwest side, southwest corner of the Chicagoland area out there in Lamont, St. James of the Sag. It's the oldest working church in Northern Illinois, established in 1833. And in doing research on the early priests, especially the first priest, a priest by the name of Irenaeus Saint-Cyr, he would travel back and forth between the Lamont area and St. Louis because he was a St. Louis priest. And if you go from St. Louis to the Chicago area, you're going to pass through, obviously, central Illinois. And there's a number of letters between that priest, Father Irenaeus Saint-Cyr, and his bishop from St. Louis, a bishop by the name of Rosati, and also a French bishop in France who used to be in Detroit. And I'm delighted to share with you the discovery of some of these letters that pointed to the incredible influence of Catholicism in the life of the young Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's cousin, Abraham Lincoln, the president, had a cousin named Abraham Lincoln. One of his uncles had a boy named, and he named him Abraham. So there are these two Abraham Lincolns. They were cousins. And the other Abraham Lincoln wasn't in politics or what have you, but he lived in a little town in central Illinois by the name of Fountain Green. And there you can find his grave in a small little country graveyard. And so the first priest of St. James of the Sag, St. Irenaeus Saint-Cyr, saw the Lincolns a few times and visited them because the bishop, long after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, and the bishop was writing to Father Saint-Cyr and said, "Did you ever meet the Lincolns?" And he said, "Yes, on several occasions I did." because the priest, Father Irenaeus Saint-Cyr, said the young future president even served Mass for me a few times. And then he quickly added, but he wasn't a Catholic, and he didn't seem to be interested in becoming Catholic, but he was polite, and he even he made six chairs for me that he gifted me with one time. There's this, why does the young Abraham Lincoln, the future president, have such a connection with Catholicism? And I firmly believe that his father's, who remarried after his biological mother died, was Catholic. His biological father remarries a woman from Kentucky. They moved to Illinois, and I believe, and I'd love to find out evidence of this, but she was Catholic. And so she would have influenced him. Being out in the middle of nowhere, so to speak, you wouldn't see that many priests so much, but she would have certainly try to train him as best you can, prepare him for First Holy Communion. And this second letter that I discovered, a letter between Father Irenaeus Saint-Cyr and this priest who used to be in Detroit, and now when he was older, living in France, the priest from France said, absolutely, Abraham, the young future president, was Catholic. He says straight out that he confessed to me on a number of occasions. The young Abraham Lincoln confessed to this future bishop on a number of occasions. But that French bishop quickly adds, he didn't stick with it. And he adds that his political ambitions choked him. His political ambitions required that he be not be a Catholic and especially make friends with Masons and other such Protestant groups. So he abandoned being a Catholic in order to be a little more acceptable in the high society of that time down in Kentucky and obviously future also in Illinois. So I look at those little bits of historical evidence and see he, even though he didn't become Catholic, stay Catholic, whichever way, I bet he was baptized.
Wow.
I bet he was baptized a Catholic.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
But the spirit of Catholicism lives in him because you could see it in his approach to the American Civil War. There's two especially Catholic threads in Abraham Lincoln, the president, that I got to share with you. I'll do that as soon as we come back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported, my friends, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Es tiempo de cuaresma para reflexionar y ver cómo estamos como matrimonios, como padres de familia o como cristianos católicos. Conferencia familiar con la psicóloga católica Lupita Venegas. Esta conferencia se llevará a cabo en el gimnasio de la escuela de San Estanislao Kostka, ubicada el 1255 Norte de la Noble, en Chicago, Illinois, el sábado 4 de abril de 2020, de 2 de la tarde hasta las 7 de la noche. Para comprar su boleto, pueden ir a la página del internet de la parroquia de San Estanislao, stanschurch.org, y pueden seguir las instrucciones ahí en la misma página. Los boletos son $30 por persona. El cupo es limitado. De nuevo, conferencia familiar con la psicóloga católica Lupita Venegas, 4 de abril del 2020, sábado. Todos quedan invitados. Esta conferencia es para matrimonios, parejas y mayores de 18 años. No niños, por favor. Que Dios los bendiga.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Sometimes in life, we are confronted with the tyranny of choice. I know. Stop or go. Hot or cold. Up or down. This way or that way. You can contribute to Winds of Change one way or the other. One way is to go to windsofchangeshow.com. Then click on Support Winds of Change Show in the upper right-hand corner of the page. The other is to go to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to make your donation, one way or the other.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I was sharing some thoughts on Abraham Lincoln so far, since today's his birthday, but this is whenever day you're listening to it, it's most valuable. And I shared with you some of the historical documents that point to Abraham Lincoln's Catholic connections through his early childhood. But I want to point out two what I consider very Catholic philosophical principles that guided his presidency. One is is the understanding that the Bible alone can't solve all our problems. When faced with a difficult issue, oftentimes the Bible gives guidance, but the authorities of the day need to make a proclamation, make a decision that is not exactly stated in the scriptures. That means you're resorting to natural law as opposed to simply divine revealed law, or we could say you're resorting to natural law instead of what the Bible says. That's an innately Catholic position as opposed to Protestant Christianity. And that Abraham Lincoln knew he had to exercise the authority of the presidency with an authority that didn't exactly come from the Bible. Obviously, there's so much in the Bible that points to the freedom, anti-slavery attitude in life. Obviously, the Israelites were in slavery in Egypt, and the whole story of the Israelites being freed from the bondage of Israel. So many times Scripture can and has been used to defend the right to have slavery. As a matter of fact, some of you might remember I put together a little play by two Catholic bishops that were involved in the slavery issue. A northern bishop, a Bishop Purcell from Cincinnati, and a southern bishop, Bishop Verrall from Virginia and subsequently Florida. And when I read Bishop Verrall's sermon on defending slavery, he used scripture left and right, up and down. And you listen to him and I was literally shocked at my reaction. I was mad at myself for saying to myself, wow, he's making a lot of sense, because you don't want to be convinced that slavery is a good thing. But Bishop Verrall, the Catholic bishop at that time, down in the South, did exactly that. So my point is that Lincoln, by taking the abolitionist position eventually and to the end, had to resort to wisdom outside the Bible. And that calls into question the great pillar of Protestant theology, namely sola scriptura. So the Bible alone. The Bible is the only place you can find those truths that are necessary for salvation. You could certainly make a good argument that getting the issue of slavery right is necessary for salvation. As a matter of fact, we had a wonderful talk. Some of you may know of a little group that we have going on the southwest side out there in the southwest suburbs called the Catholic Professionals of Illinois. Dr. Mary Beth Zukowski does a beautiful job organizing. And we had a wonderful doctor by the name of Lyle, Dr. Lyle, who is an OB-GYN doctor. And he gave a presentation on the operations that doctors do to babies in the womb. They can do heart surgery to a baby in the womb, or if it is detected that a baby in the womb looks like it has spinal bifida, they can do some back surgery to their spine while in the womb. If they have blood disease, they could introduce medicine to help counteract blood disease. And there's just an amazing things they do with tiny little surgical instruments. And his main point to us all was that if you're treating these little beings in the womb as patients, then they got to be persons. You wouldn't treat a turnip or a tomato with such care and expense, of course. So the fact that they're patients means that they're persons is beautiful. I never really appreciated that angle before, but he, in his work, certainly sees it. I actually asked him. He was a Baptist man and a good and believing, God-fearing man, no doubt. And I had to tell him that he's my kind of Christian during the question and answers. And I asked him the question, does all your scientific discoveries, this wisdom that you're getting not from the Bible, but from your microscope and from your laboratories and from your knowledge as a scientist, does that cause you to question the fundamental principle upon which all Protestant denomination, Protestant theology is based on, namely sola scriptura? Unfortunately, his response, I didn't expect his response, he says, what does that mean? He never heard of the phrase sola scriptura. He says, well, that's a Latin phrase. I don't know what it means. So, which indicates to me that there's many people hold on to Protestant denominations in their heart and soul, but they don't know the history of the Reformation. They don't know that sola scriptura is, if that falls, if that principle falls, then Catholicism has to be your backup. That's got to be where you run to, because we don't believe in sola scriptura. We believe in scriptura. We believe in the Bible, but we don't believe the Bible is the only place where you get wisdom. You do get wisdom from the Bible, but you also can get wisdom outside the Bible, namely through natural law. And that's why I'm saying Abraham Lincoln showed a Catholic spirit when he knew that he had to use wisdom, that not just the Bible. He had to use natural law thinking to interpret the Bible, as it were. And he also knew that as president, there's this hierarchy. This is the other Catholic twist I see so strongly in Abraham Lincoln. And I think it's not unfair to attribute it to the fact that even as a boy, he got some good Catholic theology and good Catholic philosophy inside of him, and it stayed with him. Because as in the Catholic thinking, we have this respect for hierarchy, knowing that obeying a superior doesn't mean you are against freedom. Okay, that's a strange kind of way to say it, but us Catholics were supposed to be trained to realize that our sense of hierarchy, our sense of superiors, is supposed to protect us, help us, guide us in the right way. And to be an obedient Catholic and to obey church authorities is not to be against freedom. We believe it helps us live more freely because it helps us live more outside the slavery of sin, to put it bluntly. And so we need that kind of hierarchy. And I see that was something that Abraham Lincoln held on to. Anyways, with the little bit of time left we have here today, I wanted to share a thought that I had last Sunday, because last Sunday we heard the reading about you are the salt of the earth, but what if salt loses its flavor? How can it get salty again? I shared with my congregation some thoughts on depression, because the idea of salt losing its flavor reminded me of life losing its pizzazz. In other words, when we're depressed. And I was thinking about how we react and how do we overcome depression. Shared a few thoughts, but one of the key thoughts had to do with a disappointment I have with a kind of the modern Catholic liturgy, which is quite popular today. And what I find as a contributor to our depressed states in life, or at least not a good antidote to our depressed times in life. I certainly want to say that those who are really fighting depression in a real deep way, there are wonderful psychologists and psychiatric treatment ways that can help in a very severe case. Though good Catholic psychologists are a little hard to find, I think everyone should be aware that you have to have some good references to see, because some of the principles in modern psychology will be making the same mistake that I'm going to talk about. That's in the liturgy. What I'm referring to is when you are depressed, it is often connected to the idea that your self-sacrifices go unappreciated. I just try to illuminate that a little bit. Depression is often related to an experience where you have made self-sacrifices, and those in your inner circle, the most important people that you wish or want to or feel should appreciate your self-sacrifices, they don't appreciate your self-sacrifice. I even related it to the rule of celibacy as a priest, because it's kind of like I just heard today that Pope Francis wrote an apostolic letter regarding the Amazonian Synod, where he said he was not in favor. He wasn't going to recommend married priests for the Amazon missions. He said beautifully that we got to emphasize the missionary spirit more to go into such a part of the world. And but if and when, and a lot of Catholics, of course, do support married priests, and I humbly confess that there have been times in my life when I certainly thought married priests was a good answer. But I share with you now that as I'm older and I believe I'm wiser, that I'm against married priests, because it might be delightful, it might be nice for me as an individual, but it would not be good for the church as a corporate body, as the body of Christ, the mystical body of Christ. And so that spirit of my self-sacrifice, those who are really for married priests don't appreciate my self-sacrifice, so that does make it a little depressing, just being honest. So, but the spirit of the modern liturgy, then, that is always celebrating, is reticent and loath to sing songs that refer to our need for penance or that our Lord suffered. In a typical Catholic liturgy, there has to be upbeat songs. There have to be upbeat sermons. Everything has to be positive. Everything has to be celebratory. So you come in and you don't get that. If you are depressed, you don't feel that the Lord is one who listens to your or sympathizes with your self-sacrifice. Because if no one else sympathizes with your self-sacrifice, you go to a mass, more traditional mass, and you know Jesus sympathizes with your self-sacrifice. It's a little point about depression and how we should overcome it and how our prayer life could help. I'm Father Tom Coyce. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.